connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Ave Mario.
Mario's dead.
Yeah. R.I.P. R.I.P. is real.
Yeah.
I think they say.
He died at a ripe old age of 35, surrounded by loved ones and 34 copies of him.
Welcome back to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I'm your co-host, Galen, and with me, as always, is Matt. But today we are somber episode to honor the red plumber that brought so many smiles to so many faces.
So, actual context here. this is sort of a sort of state of the meme.
A half state of the meme.
Yeah, no automaton this time, but we do get Ave Mario. So the joke is that on was it just April something?
On April 1st, like the last day was March 31st. So on April 1st,
right?
so yeah, on April 1st. For March of last year, Nintendo released Super Mario 35, I think it was, and the Mario 3D All-Stars Collection for the 35th anniversary of Mario. Makes sense. The weird thing about it was that it was a timed exclusive.
Well, there's two things. So one thing, the 3D All-Stars is a timed exclusive because they want to create artificial demand. It's even the digital release of it on the Switch shop was a timed exclusive that is no longer purchasable. This is something they've done a lot before. I'm not surprised that they did this, because they did it with previous Mario collections. They did it with the Kirby collection, the Metroid Prime collection. Nintendo makes it very hard to buy their old games.
Yeah.
The Mario 35 thing, though, was like a battle royale type game, very similar to Tetris 99, where you're playing Mario and sending like enemies to enemy screens or to other player screens. But for the most part, you're kind of playing your own single player game while sending enemies. And I think it was free with Nintendo Switch Online, much like Tetris 99. But yeah, they only had the servers going for a whole year. And even though they had this completely new game made, because it had like a lot of unique mechanics to it, it wasn't just the original Mario. And even though it was fairly popular from what I understand, they decided to remove it anyways with the passing of Mario's 35th anniversary. And I think that's what's really bizarre to me. And it's like, Nintendo's kind of always been at the forefront of like the conversation of digital preservation, because they do this type of stuff constantly. They just like I said, they don't like people buying their old games. They make it hard to do. And so it's annoying that for such a big milestone that they made to be a big milestone, they just kind of shut the door as soon as the 1 year was up.
Yeah, it's also it's weird because like there's My immediate thought goes to, like, the closing of the Wii Shop channel, for example. The Wii Shop channel had a lot of original content, like, original WiiWare content to itself. But at the same time, when they closed that, it had been over a decade. They gave, like, really heavy prior warning. I understand why they did it, and they gave people, like, as much chance as possible to kind of like get what they need and preserve what they could, more or less. Not that there was their explicit goal or anything. But for Mario 35, Mario's 35th anniversary, and for the Battle Royale specifically, like, yeah, they were up front. This is happened. This is going until this year, but that's 1 year.
Yeah.
That is, get in the good times now. This is never going to be a playable game again unless someone violates a DMCA claim.
Unless they open the Nintendo Vault. which is just a giant Mario question block. And Miyamoto opens it, and then, like, Aladdin on the Sega Genesis comes out. So, people were making a bunch of jokes about Mario being dead because of that. It's kind of funny in the sense of, like, you know, Mario's not actually dying, it's just those games are gone. But also, it is, like, you know, it's kind of upsetting that they'll do this type of thing so often. And I think people are starting to get annoyed even more with Nintendo for it.
Yeah, like, it's one thing for, like, your physical mini consoles to be extremely scarce. That's still also dumb, but is also, like, all right, sure, that's a physical product that you can, you know, market on its direct, like, scarcity. But 3D All-Stars was digitally available.
Right,
It's not even just like this is a physical print. It's I own 3D All-Stars. I still own 3D All-Stars. It was digitally available. I bought it before it came off. There's no reason that it shouldn't be available anymore.
We're reaching the like apex of phase one of the Nintendo cycle, which is they get a popular console, they get really complacent and do some stupid shit, then their next console does not sell as well because they were getting too complacent. And, like, didn't market it correctly or didn't produce it in a way that meant, you know, sales or whatever. And then they lose money. Then they realize they have to innovate and push something that people will, like, repeat.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at, like, consoles, at least since the Nintendo 64, it went N64, then GameCube didn't sell well, then Wii worked wonders, then Wii U didn't sell well, and then Switch worked wonders. So I'm totally expecting their next console to not do as well.
If they even make one, to be fair.
I mean, like, yeah.
They might just be releasing updates of the Switch, which I will also say, I personally would be fine with. I'd be fine with just, here's another Switch, but with more power.
Yeah, I need more quantum power. I also did want to say one thing in regards to April Fool's jokes.
Yes.
You know, April Fool's is this really weird holiday now because so many corporations want to get in on it. And, like, a lot of corporations don't have any sort of tone appreciation, I guess. Like, they make a lot of bad jokes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's always notable when something makes a good joke. And I really want to shout out to the studio behind Rivals of Aether, who is now just called Aether Studios, previously Dan Farnese LLC. So they do a lot of really fun things. 2 years ago, they did Lovers of Aether, which was a dating simulator visual novel set in an alternate universe of their game. And they released that, and it's like an actual game you can play. Then last year, they added Rivals of Tether, which was a tetherball game mode to Rivals of Aether. This year, for their Rivals Direct, which is where they announce things, they did an interactive Twitch Plays visual novel, where it's in the universe of Lovers of Aether, but it was a Twitch Plays thing where, like, people in chat could vote on what to do next, and then whenever there's a dialogue choice, people in chat vote on which option to take. But they also had some incredible things, like a drawing segment, where people in chat could choose one of 8 directions for the pen to go, and it would draw a line in that direction. And then there was also an actual game of Rivals of Aether that they played with Twitch, where, similarly to Twitch Plays Pokemon, chat would choose what buttons to press, and it would start pressing those buttons. And I like to think I was instrumental in this succeeding, because everybody was pretty scattered until, at some point, everybody collectively decided to start doing down smash, and I definitely posted everybody spam down smash. So I like to think I was the one who started that. And what's great is the devs did not expect chat to win that. They said, like, in testing, they were never able to collectively beat the one AI they had. So, yeah, take that. I helped organize an army to take down one lion in Rivals of Aether.
Thank you very much for coming to our TED Talk about the powers of unionization. Please go out to your workplaces and, organize your labor.
Yes. And, don't vote in politicians that are anti-union.
Yes.
Don't cross picket lines.
I want to briefly highlight two other April Fools that were just, they weren't corporate, but they were probably my favorites. Siva Gunner. for the entirety of April 1st, they had basically Mario songs minus Mario. So, like, instead of Super Mario Galaxy, it was Super Galaxy.
The disappearance of Mario Mario.
Yeah. My favorite title being Mario Bros., the original, like, you know, side-scrolling, jumping on the Koopa and stuff, is just Bros.
I loved Golf as well.
Yeah, Golf is also so good.
Party.
And the second April Fool's joke is Dunkey released the top 10 hottest Mario females, which is, it's not a word-for-word parody of the top 10 Sonic females, hottest Sonic females, which is a sort of infamous video. It's also a really fucking hilarious video. Go watch it. But like he quotes from it a lot for comedic effect, and the general structure is extremely good. Like how when he's talking about Daisy, he's like, in Mario Wii, she is part of the medium class, and also just it's so good. It's 5 minutes. Go watch it.
Yeah. His delivery is really good when he does this, like, fake YouTuber. You know, the type that's like, top 10. Very MatPat-ish.
Before we see a take wing.
Yeah, so those were not corporate, but the other stuff we talked about, I mean, I guess the Mario thing was pretty anti-corporate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a segue into what our main topic is, which is very complicated to describe, and so most of this episode will be describing it.
Yes.
Kind of a Borgesian object of affixation. Is that a word, Borgesian? It should be.
Borgesian? We can coin it here. TV tropes. TV tropes, when you take this term, remember to credit us.
Yeah.
TM, TM, TM.
Okay, so, yeah.
With that, with the intro out of the way, let's segue into the main topic. Everybody, please get out your shutter shades. Get out your DeLoreans that you can drive at midnight in a neon city through that's probably somewhere in like California or Florida or something like that. And let's take you to the month of April Wave.
I just realized I was starting to do the home song Summoning Salt uses. So April Wave is our month where we're talking about Vaporwave. Vaporwave is a very complex topic, so we're going to try to explain it.
But Matt, what is a Vaporwave?
That's actually, like, the first note I have is me saying, what the fuck is Vaporwave?
The Fact Corner.
So Vaporwave started as a music genre inspired by music from the 80s and 90s. By the way, this is technically Fact Corner. So it often relies on sampling things like old pop songs, smooth jazz, or corporate muzak, and slowing them down and chopping them, usually with also heavy reverb and a lot of other, like, audio filters and effects. It very heavily creates this sort of feeling of etheria. It drew heavily from chillwave, which is another genre from, like, the early 2010s. That was focused heavily on nostalgia and a sort of dreamlike sound. The themes of, like, nostalgia, but also this sort of idealized vacation lifestyle of being in, like, Miami, you know, tropical imagery, a lot of, like, ocean imagery, neon is pretty heavy. All of that carried over from chillwave to vaporwave, as did the general focus on older sounds like 80s synths. Vaporwave as we know it, though, is more structurally rooted in plunderphonics, which is the mindset of repurposing other sounds to create new music, which we sort of covered in our Avalanches episode.
Yeah, so, corporate reclamation, I think we kind of called it in a sense.
Yeah. So there were two main albums that kickstarted the genre as we sort of know it. The first was Echo Jams by Chuck Person, a.k.a. Daniel Lopatin. I think that's how you pronounce it. Daniel is also known as 10tricks.never, who is an electronic artist that heavily uses these sort of chopped samples and slowed. I would argue, honestly, that Replica by 10tricks.never is another sort of precursor in this sort of glitchy style of chopping up commercials. But the one that people mostly credit is Echo Jams, which sampled a lot of these older, like, 80s and 90s pop songs, like songs from Michael Jackson and Toto and Fleetwood Mac, and like slowed them down really heavily to where every single sort of instrument was drawn out. It uses a lot of samples that are sort of anxiety driven, like the sound and speed of the samples would constantly shift around. There's a lot of layering of samples to create the sort of feeling that the CD was not only skipping, but like repeating over itself and constantly building up. And then it would like suddenly settle into a comfortable spot only to get shifted up again. The other main album that spawned Vaporwave was Farside Virtual by James Ferraro, who is another sort of experimental electronic artist. Farside Virtual was much more focused heavily on corporate music, both sampling things like commercials and corporate, like, background noise, but also sound effects from things like Skype and the Wii. Farside Virtual was pretty upbeat, whereas Echo Jams was really mellow, and Farside Virtual also uses a lot more of, like, melodic composition. But it did so in a way that's very co-opting of corporate themes. Together, these albums set many standards later Vaporwave artists would follow, such as the slowed, chopped, and edited samples, a focus on Muzak and pop from the 80s and 90s, and a heavy, heavy co-opting of corporate art and sound. This includes the album covers. Echo Jam's album cover is a broken and sort of puzzle piece together cover of Echo the Dolphin, and Farside Virtual uses the Memphis style of corporate imagery, as per the Y2K Aesthetic Institute, which, by the way, follow Y2K Aesthetic Institute, Evan Collins. So, it uses the, like, corporate sort of, kind of generic artsy style of that, along with, like, a low-res digital photo in the background. And so, as the time kind of progressed, those core ideas founded Vaporwave. And Vaporwave artists heavily leaned into the anti-corporate side. Usually they'd use names like Cat System Corp or Redefining the Workplace. Like, you know, very, very obviously trying to sound like a fake corporation from something. And they lean heavily into similar visual motifs as those previous albums. A music scholar, Laura Glitzos, noted that Vaporwave is a music genre heavily tied to its visual language, and so it's pretty different from other genres that are mostly focused on sound. And I think that's really poignant because, like, that was all about Vaporwave, the music genre, but there is also the Vaporwave, the aesthetic. But, like, aesthetic in fancy words with spaces between them. So the aesthetic, as it were, of Vaporwave is, like I said, like, neon, a lot of tropical imagery, and, like, a lot of ocean imagery. A lot of palm trees and other plants, but also like a lot of like businessy renders or like renders of houses and stuff from like 90s magazines, 90s design magazines. It uses a lot of corporate iconography, and then also in a greater sense, it uses a lot of marble. And I think Floral Shop, the album we are talking about today, was pretty pivotal in focusing on that. It really fits because, on one hand, marble and statues and stuff have already been used to sort of give the feeling of luxury at, like, hotels and resorts. So it is sort of, you know, a sold, packaged idea of this is living the good life that Vaporwave very much criticizes.
Yeah, the way that Vaporwave sort of uses its idealized 80s imagery is very much a, like, self-critique. It uses it ironically, but without directly, like, saying anything ironic about it, necessarily. In the sense that, like, the images that it conjures up of, you know, a landscape made out of wireframes, the palm trees, the, like, you know, orange and red sun, the marble, they sort of within context seem to be using them unironically, but with the outer context that we have, you understand the irony of it. Like, they are made so that internally it seems like there's no irony, but the, like, external context that we understand is what gives it the anti-corporate meat.
Right. There's also a lot of motifs of, like, that are borrowed from cyberpunk. Obviously the neon, but also there's a lot of focus on, like, Japanese text in writing, which, I mean, cyberpunk uses that as sort of a, like, an Asian yellow scare sort of thing. You know, not very good to remember. Kind of racist. But
yeah.
But when Vaporwave uses it, it's in the context of, like, the artist is pretending to be this mega corporation. And so they're kind of, like, role-playing as a company from a cyberpunk universe. And they're using that to drive home this idea of, like, a corporation that wants you to feel good. But but in the end, like, that's not the effect that comes across. It feels like some weird form of sedation. And or, like, some weird form of, like, nightmare. And so it kind of works in the sense that you're not supposed to look at that and be worried about the future necessarily. Like, that's not the part of it that you should be afraid of. The part you should be afraid of is the part with, like, corporate music drowning out slowly as you're, like, falling asleep. And yeah, there's, like, there's a sense of nostalgia in a lot of Vaporwave that is sort of nostalgia for, like, 90s era advertisements and, like, early web, you know, web 1.0 or whatever, like, GeoCities, low poly imagery and, like, early computer generated imagery. Think, like, Money for Nothing, that type of style is also very prevalent. And so I think that sort of plays into that, this idea of, like, using old cyberpunk imagery, which was a, like, a visual genre that was kind of dormant for a while. I think nowadays it's obviously popular because, you know, cyberpunk, but, you know, like, in the 90s, I don't think there was quite as much as the 80s. I could be wrong, though.
Yeah, it seems to have kind of, like, it seems to have had that dip where, like, you know, I think of, you know, Blade Runner, which was obviously an extremely, extremely good movie that was, I think, mid-80s, I want to say, that sort of helped define the cyberpunk genre, where, you know, once we got to the 2000s, say, we had more things like The Matrix that were, like, using similar themes, but were, like, directly using the, you know, soulless sort of green text on black background, like, that sort of aesthetic. They switched from the, like, painting over it with neon colors into the, like, this is what office is, you know? Right.
The Matrix uses a lot of, like, its visual style is much more similar to the sort of, Y2K era, like, corporate, like, style of design, or, like, you know, something you would see on, like, a math textbook from that era.
Yeah.
So it's still very much rooted in, like, this is what the future could become, but it's more of a Western corporate style.
Yeah. I think a lot of the themes of cyberpunk, or not cyberpunk, of Vaporwave can be seen in, like, some of the most popular media with it. So, for example, to my mind, I'm not going to get too far into them. I'm just going to use a brief overview because obviously this episode is about Floral Shop, but Hotline Miami, a very popular video game. It uses the, like, bright neon, the 80s aesthetic, the, you know, it's got the car, the DeLorean car. It's got the, you know, neon pink and blue sort of fading background. It's got the electronic music, but it uses that style for a game that is about incredibly violently beating up members of the Russian mob and being a psychopath.
Yeah. Hotline Miami is very punchy in terms of, like, the volume and the pace of the music as well. It kind of goes into psychedelic a bit more, but, like, those are some very weird, minute distinctions.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I was gonna say, sort of, the one thing is that that soundtrack doesn't have as much of the, like, slow, droning style.
Yeah, the music itself isn't directly Vaporwave, but the aesthetic is, the visual aesthetic is very heavily influenced by it, and the disconnect between the, like, idealized reality versus the reality of you murdering people is, I think, what, like, what you can see in the Vaporwave influence in it.
Right.
Yeah.
So going back to the visual style a bit, it's definitely something we'll talk about more in future episodes over this month. But I think when we talk about Floral Shop, I really want to bring up sort of its cover, because its album cover is itself sort of a defining cover.
Yeah, it is incredibly iconic. The second song on the album is like probably the defining, like when you think of a vaporwave song, you think of this song.
Right. If those other two albums were the ones that set a lot of the genre, like, defining motifs, this is the album that popularized it. So Floral Shop was released in 2011, created by artist Vectroid under the alias Macintosh Plus. Vectroid is itself an alias, but she has a lot of other names she goes under when she releases music, all under kind of the Vectroid label. It was an early example of vaporwave, which we kind of talked about. So Floral Shop itself focuses mainly on sampling, like, a few main sources per song, and then layering those samples, slowing them down, chopping them, all the good, like, audio distortion effects. A general sort of description of the way the album sounds is that it's sort of like listening to slowed down pop music coming through the speakers at an old mall boutique. Or like playing through speakers at a water park. There is a pretty big focus of like audio fidelity. And I think that's part of the aesthetic of the visuals, is being able to cement yourself in the location that the visuals represent. And they do so often by using that sort of reverb and, you know, very like sort of lo-fi filters. The album has been released and re-released multiple times, so there's like the core, like 11 tracks or so, and then there's some bonus tracks. I mainly have notes about the main tracks, not as many about the bonus tracks.
I have kind of sparse notes about the main tracks. I do actually have, I believe, a note over everything in the bonus tracks, maybe.
Right.
I'm probably missing one, but... like the core of the album is number 1 to 9, and then 10 and 11 is like also pretty like directly in there.
Right.
Like the very original was just 9, but then there was a reissue 1 year later that had 2 extra, so it's basically part of the core album.
Yeah. So the cover of the album, I want to talk about this.
Yes.
So, super iconic. It has a pink background with sort of a black checkered floor. In the top, there is the name of the album, the name of the artist, written in Japanese text. There's a little Qbert-looking stack of cubes with, like, a little logo. And then there is a image of, like, a cityscape. The cityscape is really hazy, as if ran through a CRT on a public access TV station. It's also pretty dark, like very orange and purple, so it definitely has that sort of Midnight City aesthetic, but not the song Midnight City. The most prominent feature, though, is the marble bust in the foreground. So like I said, the sort of marble and ancient Greco-Roman styles are very already corporate, used to sort of sell vacation destinations. Think of like a bunch of resorts and hotels that use that imagery of like columns and arches and stuff. But the bust also is taken out of that sense of luxury. It's just kind of there. It's just a head, you know. It has this really rough and old feeling. Not just old as far as like the period it's from, but like the material looks like it's breaking off at parts, which definitely fits that nostalgic feeling vaporwave tries to evoke of like an idealized past that both wasn't real and you couldn't achieve because it was like a past that was sold to you. And then also the blank stare of the statue kind of matches the droning, drowned out chill wave sort of sound. Very much like sedated, like I said.
The imagery of the marble statue and like compared directly to the like CRT postcard-esque skyline is, I think, very... It obviously it has the roots in what you said, the like idealized past. I also think it has a bit of a like this is the future as well sort of message behind it. Like it obviously is using that imagery of like the chipped marble to sort of, you know, poke at the synthetic nature of it. But it also is kind of directly comparing them in the sense that, like, this is part of life now, and it's probably not going to not be part of life for a while. Like, even the marble statues that are scuffed, that are, you know, broken, that are, you know, lost even, are still there. They are still present. And so I think it kind of, it highlights that not only is this, you know, sort of a false beauty, a false, you know, reverence, but unless something happens, it will still be there in the future. We will still be living in this skyline.
It also feels like a window almost, sort of the position of the skyline. It kind of feels like if you were in a skyscraper across like a bay.
Yeah.
And so, like, it kind of gives the feeling of, like, you're inside some weird corporate executive office.
I think that, as well, the imagery of the 90s renders, which is a little more prevalent in other Vaporwave things, but, like, obviously has some prevalence here with the, like, checkered floor. I think the imagery of the 90s renders also speaks to a sort of, like, attempt to escape, you know? Like, or a will to want to live in this 90s idealized world. It's criticizing, but it also admits that, like, at the end of the day, wouldn't we all want this marble statue? Wouldn't we all want this idealized skyline, you know?
Right. I don't have anything else to say about the cover, but keep in mind those sort of motifs as we go through the month. So I guess let's start with the actual music now. So all the tracks are written in Japanese, but I have the translated titles here. They're not too hard to find. The first track, Boot, it starts with a sort of like this flute sample going on pretty gently. And then it switches to this more ominous vocal sample from the song Tar Baby by Sade. It kind of just uses the word tar in the word baby and slows them down really hard and kind of repeats the end of them. So it doesn't really sound like words. It also has this, like, really sharp sax behind it. And so when it switches between the samples, you get the sax kind of jutting in and really kind of hurting your ears almost.
Yeah.
It's called Boot because it's the intro to the album. It has, you know, it's named after a computer booting up. This is, from what I can understand from, like, my research, this is pretty common to have sort of an intro track and then have the track named after some form of intro, as far as, like, Vaporwave artists go.
Yeah.
The next track, Lisa Frank 420, or Lisa Frank Computing 420, or Modern Computing Lisa Frank, that is the one that is the most well-known.
Yeah, that's the sting of do 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 do. If you recognize that melody, that is this song. It the specific melody is present for a lot of the song, but the underlying ethereal, it's a song that sounds bigger than it is.
Yeah.
It's a song that gives you an audio landscape of that image of driving down the boulevard at midnight in a neon city. It also has, like, the very end before it repeats the melody has, like, the vocals that cut in for just a second. Mm-hmm. That also is very, it is prevalent in no small amount of vaporwave media as well. And it really is, like, an iconic song that deserves to be remembered.
Right.
deserves to have, like, become synonymous with Vaporwave.
Right. So, it samples Diana Ross' It's Your Move, and it's one of the more coherent vocal samples with, like, the entirety of stanzas in the song being repeated. It's pretty much just really slowed down and then again layered on top of each other, which helps give it that sort of grand feeling. It's the start of it's very subdued, though. It has that sort of mall speaker sound coming through as it starts to build up. And
yeah, it has a lot of progression to it within the song.
Yeah, like, you know, when it cuts in with that vocal sample, you kind of expect it to start going through, but then it just loops again. So it really builds up anticipation that way. And then when it finally hits is when, like, all the instruments come on, and it's very, you know, very melodic that time. You know, all the parts are kind of filled in.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it then sort of slows down a bit, kind of dies down. It's also not as choppy as many of the other songs, so it's a bit easier to listen to if you're not used to that style.
Yeah. Although, speaking of choppy and melodic, if we want to go on to number three, which is my favorite track, Floral Shop is the name of the third track. And it's my favorite of the album. It very directly introduces the, like, melodic skipping, where it will play part of a song, and then it will, like, skip sort of, like, two or three notes, just sort of, like, do that four times, and then play the next few notes, but then skip another three. The weird connection that I make is, if you've ever played a Source game, hear me out. If you've ever played, like, Team Fortress 2 or another Source game, and you, like, Alt-Tab, or it rebuilds the node or whatever, you'll always get that, like, brief few seconds where it'll play, like, 2 seconds of a sound effect, and then it'll go, like, it will do that sort of, like, you know, really, really weird condensed skip, but it's also always a little bit melodic to me. I've always sort of, you know, whenever I encounter that, I always kind of imagine, like, how you could use that in a song. And the reason that I love Floral Shop is because it uses that skipping, but, like, it's a little disorienting. I tried to listen to it while driving. I actually could not. I had to turn it off. But, like, it is disorienting in a really pleasing way. And, like, there's a BPM increase about halfway through the song that, like, just... Oh, it is such a good release of tension.
Yeah. So I kind of love this. For one thing, it uses the same flute sample as the first song in the track starts with. Or the first song in the album, I mean. Has that same sample from Boot.
Yeah.
Also, so... While it does have a BPM change, the entire time the song is going, that flute loop of, like, do 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 is constantly moving in the background. And, like, no matter the like, edits that the, like, foreground sort of music, the main instrumentals go through with, like, the guitar and everything, the flute still plays at that same pace. And it's really great in, like, towards the end of the song, it really starts to clash in a way that, like, you know, the song's beauty just sort of starts to fade away and it gets muddled.
And then, as
it, you know, really starts drowning out the front part of the music with the guitar and everything, it eventually just becomes like a cymbal crash or a cymbal ride that kind of loops back and forth, you know, reversing and then repeating and then reversing, while that flute kind of comes back into focus, which I think is this really cool feeling of, like, I don't know, it feels like it's kind of this anticipation again that, like, something's going to happen with the music, but it doesn't really happen, but it's kind of hiding in the background. Sort of like a horror movie almost.
Yeah. The tension of the latter, like, half a minute of the song is extremely, compared to some of the other repeating, which I will say I don't like, some of the songs that are a lot of repeating like it, it is still easy to listen to, still fun to listen to, because, like, it has a progression within that, like, droning and slowly dying, repeating, where it's, you know, it brings back in this flute, it uses this cymbal crash, and it's sort of like, you know, it's discordant as it's going down, but it's discordant in a very coherent way.
Right. The next song is Library, which sounds like something from Spelunky at the start, which is kind of fun. it starts with this like very synthesized trumpet, and then it brings in the "You Need a Hero" sample. It kind of follows a verse chorus structure a little bit, with like instrumental, then the samples from the vocals, and then instrumental again, then samples from the vocals, and then the last part kind of just repeats a little riff of the trumpet, but at different speeds, sort of breaking from the more standard side to this like very you know, very very sudden shift. It kind of like it takes this sort of interlude for a more standard song structure, and then it's like, okay, we're done with that.
Yeah. The second half also has like it does that thing again where, like, you know, it has the repeating top layer, but then the bottom layer it adds in this sort of like, you know, consistent synth sort of you know, up and down melody that sort of like feels like you're listening to two different songs at once, basically.
Yeah. After Library is Geography, which samples Turok, the dinosaur hunter.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah. So it's this very like bass heavy sound, very like uses a lot of very low notes. I don't mean that as far as like a key, but I literally mean like low, like bell samples. If you look up like the samples that Floral Shop uses, which I highly recommend after listening to the album, you can kind of see that it's pretty much just that loop from Turok, but like, you know, smaller parts are looped and then kind of put on top of each other in different orders. It's like the song itself isn't allowed to play for more than a few beats before it has to be taken out of order.
Yeah.
It's definitely interesting because, like, when I listen to it, I do feel like I'm in some sort of dark, low-poly environment. I don't know how much of that is, like, conditioning from listening to music in this style, or if it's just, like, from playing video games, I kind of understand the vibe it's going for. Because I felt like this even before I knew the song was from Turok, but when I did know, it's like, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's sort of similar to, this is skipping forward a little bit, but Hidden Pathway, it has that similar vibe where like the melody of it feels like it's in a sneaking level in a video game before you're caught, when you're just sort of like trying to ambiently walk around. It has that electronic stealthiness to it. I will also say that I think that Geography is one of the lesser tracks for me. It is interesting, but it also kind of, I don't think it has too much progression to it. It's not the worst track on the album. We're getting to that one for me. But like it's one of the less interesting, just sort of as a song itself.
Yeah, it's interesting to me in that like it doesn't have a lot you can grasp onto. Like it doesn't have a lot of melody or vocals or anything. And it feels like it goes on forever because of that. So, like, it kind of feels like you're stuck in, like, an infinite loop, you know? Like, a time loop, where you're just kind of waiting for the song to end, but then it keeps going with no clear direction. But then we get to my favorite song of the album, Chill Divin' with Echo.
Which I assume is also a reference to Echo the Dolphin.
Yeah, it's probably specifically referencing Echo Jams, that, like, foundational album. It's a much brighter song, with a sort of like major key guitar riff coming in, and then this very striking like bell loop. Due to the name, the bells remind me of sort of glistening water in the sun, and the guitar really helps me imagine like some sort of beach. I feel like this is a great case where like the name of the song perfectly sets the tone for the song, and they really kind of work together to create what it's going for.
I think it's slightly less interesting from a specific melody standpoint compared to say Lisa Frank 420, but the like it has a very similar audio landscape to it, but like it's a lot brighter. It feels less directly cynical. It feels more like the context that it's building around you is unironically just sort of good.
Yeah. If like a lot of vaporwave is about sort of the emotion and soundscape that it puts you in, this feels like the most positive, or one of the most positive on the album. And it to me, I just find it really like relaxing. It kind of makes me happy. Part of that might just be that it's another sort of packaged and sold sort of visualized luxury vacation, you know? Like, ooh, trip to Bahamas. But
yeah,
at the same time, it's kind of fun that I can kind of travel there by listening to this song. Sounds really dorky, but you know.
Nah, I get you. Listen, the way we're talking about this album to begin with is kind of dorky.
Oh, yes.
But like, it's good vibes. Mm-hmm. Vibes is a big millennial / Gen Z thing. The vibes of this song are extremely like, just unironically, I want to put this on a feel good playlist. This is going on probably my most feel good playlist, actually.
My mostest feel goodest playlist of them all. The top spot. Number one. Right next to Bare Naked Ladies, Odds Are. So after Chill Diving with Echo, we get a song I don't like.
Yeah, Mathematics. I find it interesting.
So it has this like clanging in the background that makes me think of a train.
Yeah, it's extremely industrial. The image that comes to my mind is either like a Shinra power plant, or like just a pipe being thrown, or a wrench being dropped down a pipe forever.
Yeah, it's just like a lot of metallic sounds that kind of move at a very steady pace. There is like a, you know, like the ambience starts to build up and then it's joined by like a synth chord. And then like, as the synth chord kind of progresses, some light instruments jump in with like sax and flute and guitar. Those samples really start to like dance around each other. Sort of like, you know, one goes and then the next one and then the next one and sort of, but they eventually just start to, die back out with the clanging growing louder. Sort of a very fleeting moment of like kind of normal instruments that very frantically build up to this like feverish loop and then they just die down.
Yeah, this is going to be a weird comparison. It reminds me of Two Hearts and Three Quarters Time, my favorite song from The Avalanches, where like the beginning is disconnected from the middle, is disconnected from the end, but like it all obviously flows together, but it's this weird sandwich where it's like the beginning is, you know, is very uncomfortable. It's very discordant almost. But then like it slowly pitches in this really soothing, really, you know, kind of nice ambience like the rest of the album or like a lot of other songs in the album. But then it goes back out. It's like moving. It makes me think of like, you're the mechanic at this office and like you come out of the, you know, the mechanic's closet or whatever, where it's like, you know, a lot of stuff behind the scenes, sort of mechanical industrial building stuff. And then you walk through the lobby and it's this nice, you know, really Muzak-esque sort of placating tunes. But then you get to wherever you're going and the veil is ripped off again. You see behind it all again.
Right. After Mathematics is Standby, which is fittingly a very brief song, but it's really funky. I really like it. It's just like a pretty like danceable beat almost.
Yeah.
With some just funky guitar.
It sounds like elevator music, but like elevator music you could dance to. Mm-hmm. It's 1 minute and 10 seconds, and let me tell you, on an album that is experimental and sometimes experimental for 7 minutes, I super appreciate this one.
Yeah. It's a nice breather.
Yeah. I appreciate a really quick, really, you know, nice little bop.
Mm-hmm. So after Standby is the final album of the original release, or the final song of the original release, which is Te, just the Japanese character for Te, T-E. It's a bit more like cinematic, acting as sort of an ending than it is a, you know, a more traditional song. It opens with bird songs and triangles, and then there's like this this string part that grows in intensity really big. It kind of feels like a flock of birds of paradise lifting off and soaring.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of dies back down.
Yeah, I think if we take like the original 9 tracks as their own self-contained thing, I think you could kind of see it as like a happy ending, an escape. You know, it feels much like Chill Diving with Echo. It feels less directly cynical. It feels like a very unironic, very pleasant melody that, like, when it, if I'm remembering correctly, when it dies back down, when it fades out, it isn't like, you know, replacing that fade out with something that's, you know, more discordant. It's just sort of a very pleasant downward slope.
Yeah, I like the escape word because it's like, you know, it directly has nature with like the bird song.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really reference any sort of technology or, you know, computation or anything like that in the name. So it very much feels like you're separated from the rest of the album now. If this was like a walk through like a circle of hell that's like only for CEOs and CFOs, then this is the exit into paradise.
Yeah. But then, of course, we have the 2012 re-release, reissue, which has two more songs afterwards. Moon is my least favorite song in the album.
Mm-hmm.
So Moon has basically two major parts. It has lyrics very front and center, where it's because I only have eyes for you, dear. The moon is a big pizza pie. When a big pizza pie hits the moon like your eye, that's amore.
Bells.
bells. Yeah, it's because I only have eyes for you, dear. The moon may be. And then it cuts off and, you know, it repeats. But the reason I don't like it is because it repeats without progression. Like, I think there are some very subtle changes as it goes on. But, like, either there isn't any, or they were subtle enough to where I didn't notice, because it really does feel like you know, 20 or 25 seconds copy paste.
Yeah.
And then it has a second half which doesn't use as much of the lyrics, focuses more on the instrumental, but like, it is then the same instrumental over and over. And I certainly could see how it fits with the themes, with the vibes. But, like, even if it is interesting from a thematic standpoint within the album's sort of ideas, that doesn't make it good to listen to.
Yeah.
Necessarily. At least to me. Is, you know, artist subjective.
Yeah, so the second of these bonus tracks, Seabed, is actually, I think, my least favorite for a really similar reason. For one thing, I was surprised. This is, like, one of the most recent samples that the album has, as far as, like, when the original song was made. But Seabed is kind of similar, where it's, like, it uses just kind of the vocals slowed down with very light repetition, but not much.
Yeah.
And, like, I think what doesn't work as well for me is that the instrumentals in the background don't sound as coherent, I guess. It sounds a lot more noisy. And, like, I don't know, I'm okay with music that is hard to listen to, that, like, changes your perception of music. I have listened to 10 Tricks Point Never's Replica, which was a very difficult album to listen to. But, like, this doesn't feel the same as something like that, or, like, Mathematics, where, like, It's kind of a test, you know? This one feels kind of tacked on in a way.
Yeah. I think it has some thematic weight in that, like, it's a very discordant instrumental, but over lyrics that are like, girl, you got that sleeping pill, had me in a coma all night. So it's like, you know, it's a juxtaposition. It's ironic.
It's the most dire song.
Yeah. But, like, it also, again, you know, being thematically good doesn't necessarily mean good to listen to as well.
Yeah.
My personal headcanon is this is literally about a girl who has sleeping pills and gives them to the singer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about drugs or sex or anything. It's just, damn, that NyQuil really knocked me out.
I had a dream about birds, bird songs, flowers, Echo the Dolphin.
the entire 80s.
Babe, I'm having my Echo the Dolphin dreams again. There are two more bonus tracks that were released, I believe, on the cassette release, which itself is funny because I'm pretty sure cassettes don't have that great of a lifespan, like physically. You know, like, I'm pretty sure they have some bad decay issues.
Yeah.
Which...
It's probably along the same lines as, like, VHS.
Right. So, like, it's kind of funny to me that Vaporwave artists would do that, not just because of the whole, you know, 80s nostalgia thing, kind of like Guardians of the Galaxy, but also because it fits the vapor concept of, like, a fleeting idea that might have passed by very briefly in a foggy memory. But so the two bonus tracks, there's Foreign Bakes Aviation, which is a bit more like Muzak focused. I don't have much notes on it specifically, or the other one, Pico, not named for the Newgrounds character. That, like, I think those are, they both are easier to listen to. They're kind of like the opposite of Moon and Seabed, whereas those were like, they fit with the themes of the album and were hard to listen to. I feel like Foreign Bakes Aviation and Pico are more, like, musically easier to listen to, but might not be as potent as far as, like, connections with the rest of the album.
Yeah, I think that Aviation does a discordant sort of... The discordant nature of the song very well. Like, it is... kind of chaotic to listen to, but it's also a lot easier to listen to for me than Moon
and then,
or Seabed.
Yeah, and then I think Hidden Path was also on the cassette release.
Hidden Pathway. Okay. I'm literally on the YouTube
Are you on the YouTube, son? Need you to get off the YouTube so I can watch the football.
I'm literally on the YouTube video, and I'm trying to parse, like, okay, hang on, Hidden Path, is that one? No, but no, it's one of the ones that actually has English in its name.
Yeah.
Hidden Path, as I brought up, I actually quite like it because it sounds like something I would hear in a video game. It has to me that... you know, not just like ambience in the like ambient music spread sense, but like ambience in the I have directly heard songs like this sense. I have heard this style used before.
So that pretty much concludes all the songs on the album. Since the release of Floral Shop, Vectroid has released one more album under the alias of Macintosh Plus, which is Sick and Panic from 2019. That album uses much more dirtier sampling with a lot of like sudden chops and like skips, without as much of like a layered sort of backing synth or guitar or anything. It's a much more glitchy sound that feels more in tune with like the like hyper pop music of like 100 Gex than it does with Vaporwave.
Yeah.
And then also, I mean, Floral Shop helped really popularize Vaporwave as a whole. Its visual style was definitely, like, the album cover definitely helped a lot, but also there was a music video that was fan-made that was also very popular and also helped really push forward these, like, low-poly 90s computer graphics sort of style. Pretty much the general consensus is that Vaporwave is done, that it, like, exploded, ballooned, and burst, and kind of people have moved on from it. There's definitely not as big of a focus on Vaporwave as a whole. There are a lot of other, like, later genres that spawned from it, like future funk. I don't know if that directly spawned from it or if it was kind of a similar thing, but, like, there's other genres that are still popular. People still like Vaporwave and Chillwave, but they're mostly tied in together. And then, like, you mean lo-fi hip-hop is pretty big, and that has sort of a similar idea of, like, something that you would hear in a memory. But the one area that I think Vaporwave is still super prevalent is video games.
Yes.
And that's why the rest of the month we're covering Vaporwave video games. Because it's kind of this perfect blend of, like, people are starting to get nostalgic for low poly art, and it combines really well with the low poly art that was already in like vaporwave music.
I am so excited to talk about low poly art in video games. Yeah, well, I just want to say
the whole feeling of like wanting to escape into some virtual world from the 90s is very potent with video games.
Yeah, I mean, that's, video games are sort of like the most direct that we could interact with these styles. Mm-hmm. You know, we like art, you know, listening to the music and looking at the iconography of it, like they obviously has, you know, very, very, very potent feelings and very, very potent, you know, themes that we can glean from it. And it is a very good experience, but like video games as a medium are obviously directly interactive. And so like, it not only gives you a chance to like have an internal experience, but also have the art, like the media itself, give you that direct feedback as well.
Right. Like an apparent experience.
Yeah.
It feels really much like a genre that was kind of always meant to be a video game. That's not to say that these are like the only things that are being made with vaporwave still. A big one I want to mention is the animated series on YouTube, Enna, E-N-A, by Joel G.
Is that the, like, the girl who's half yellow, half blue?
Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's sort of similar stuff to that pretty frequently, but I think for now we're going to end it here.
Yes.
There's definitely a huge library of vaporwave music, though. I do think something I really want to bring up, check out Sounds of the Supermarket on YouTube. It is an actual album of supermarket Muzak that, like, you would play in stores. And it sounds just like vaporwave. So if there's any question of, like, vaporwave being similar to the actual corporate sound, there's, like, a prime example. It's great. I love it.
Oh, my God.
Makes me want to buy canned tomatoes.
Thank you very much for listening. I've got to, we'd love to talk more, but unfortunately I have to, you know, sit at a desk with headphones on, writing in a endless notebook with my cat in the background, while listening to chill beats that are lo-fi and 24/7.
Right. And I hear like somebody knocking on the door, and I can kind of hear their voice. It kind of sounds like, yahoo! So I think I need to be pretty worried. I think I'm going to get BLJ'd into my rooms pretty quickly. So yeah, thank you for listening. You can follow us on social media at NetSurferPro on Facebook and Twitter. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a review. Give us a comment. Give us that sweet, sweet SEO. And you know, let us know if there's anything specific you'd want to be covered, because we're interested in ideas.
Yeah.
Not because we're running out. Don't get us wrong. We have at least another year.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much on the internet. We've got, like, Overwatch 2.
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming. I tweet things. Yeah, that's what you do on Twitter, I guess. I tweet things I work on, though. You can follow my other podcast, Board Game Bros, where we talk about, well, me and my brother talk about board games, not Galen. He was only on there once, long ago.
And never again.
Yep.
Maybe again someday.
And then you can follow me on Twitch at Twack, twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream Monday, Wednesday, Friday from like 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. Play a lot of competitive games, roguelites, do some speedruns, do some platformers, you name it.
You can follow me on Twitter at Galen Wilson. That's GalenWilson0n. I tweet out my hot takes and retweet some cool stuff that I see. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube. I swear one of these days I will have a video on there. And you can find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire, twitch.tv/machinegunvampire. I may or may not stream at some point.
Nice.
But with that, thank you very much for watching.
See
with
ya.
Your ears.
Yes.
Because it's vaporwave.
Ear watchers.